This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and to entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with the owner of a company that provides educational jet fighter cockpit experiences. In the news, Amazon Air adds turboprops to the fleet, Boeing 777X certification slows, a new 4K Ultra HD flight data recorder with cellular data offload, Virgin Galactic gets FAA approval for commercial passenger space flights, and exiting the aircraft as it taxis. Also, airports coping with the drought, a 1960s plane crash mystery, and staffing up for an eVTOL future. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 659 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and military aviation expert.
Hey, everyone. Looking forward to a good conversation this week about missing airplanes or parts of airplanes.
Yeah, that and a few other topics as well to help us with those. Also joining us is, of course, Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft.
And I'm an expert at staying cool. The hot temperatures in the Northwest are just north of us. So here in the San Francisco Bay Area, we are surviving handily. But I'd hate to be 100, 150 miles north where things are really hot right now.
Record heat. Very unpleasant. Well, one thing that's not unpleasant is our reporter-at-large, Launchpad Merzari. He's with us this episode as well.
Happy to be here, and hello to all the ships at sea and planes in the air. And remember, the best part about heat waves, you don't have to worry about somebody hiding in the backseat of the car to jump you.
I guess not. I'll have to think about that one. Our guest this episode is Dewey Larson. He's owner of Dream Big Entertainment, LLC, and that's a company that gives you the opportunity to sit in the cockpit of a fighter jet. Now, Dream Big Entertainment travels within the United States. They attend air shows and festivals, fairs, and other events, and they share the history and the opportunity to experience a A7D Corsair II and an F-18 Hornet cockpit. Dewey, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I truly appreciate the opportunity and looking forward to chit-chatting aviation with you guys.
Always a great time had doing that. Now, Dewey, just quickly, and we'll get into it in more detail coming up, but these cockpits aren't old relics in well-used condition. Are they restored?
Absolutely. I consider my cockpits to be road-ready, and when they're road-ready, they've been restored. And, I mean, all of them do have a history. However, by the time I have them and they're been reworked and gone over, then they are restored to their former luster and allowing new generations the opportunity to experience something that once was very significant for our military. So that's my job.
Dewey, were you at Sun and Fun? Did I see you there?
Absolutely, you did. I was at Sun and Fun. Ah. Yeah, yeah. I'm the guy with half of the plane, which makes me half a pilot. So,
all right. We're going to get into that in just a few minutes. But first, we've got some of the aviation news from the past week. Is everybody ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready deep in the heart of.
Hit it.
Our first story comes from the Air Current. This is Amazon Air set to add ATR turboprops to freighter fleet. Now, sources have told the Air Current that Amazon Air plans to add about 10 leased ATR 72-500 freighters to its fleet of Boeing aircraft. Now, it looks like Amazon is continuing its strategy here to reach smaller communities and provide one-day deliveries, which is it never ceases to amaze me that you can order something and who knows where it comes from, and the next day it's there, sometimes in less than 24 hours. This is, I guess, not completely unexpected, but these ATRs are an interesting addition to the fleet of Amazon Boeing aircraft.
Not a surprise at all when you figure that FedEx, for example, flies probably close to 40 ATRs of different models. And they've got a lot of other turboprops in the fleet as well. They've got almost 250 Cessna Caravan, Cessna 208s. And if you think about why we don't have many turboprops flying in the passenger market anymore, it doesn't have anything to do with cost. It really has to do with passenger comfort. You know, cost per mile is a lot cheaper on the turboprops. So I would expect that Amazon will be getting a lot more of these turboprops in the future because it's going to be cost effective.
What's an ATR look like?
A smallish turboprop.
Well, you know, high wind, is it, you know?
It's an interesting looking plane. I mean, if you take it, it's almost if you took the fuselage of a maybe a 737, you put a high wing across the top and put two props on it with a T-tail, that's pretty much your ATR.
That's right. Yeah, twin engine turboprop.
High wing. Okay, got it.
High wing. Yeah, it's a well-respected, I would say, regional carrier. It's been around since, for a long time. Late 80s, early 90s, yep. I think. Yeah, and the cargo version, of course, has got a significant capacity. Amazon Air doesn't, I don't believe, operate these and the other aircraft that they have themselves, but contract with other airlines to do that, which kind of makes sense because, I mean, after all, Amazon is not an aircraft operator, doesn't, you know, that's not their expertise. So they rely on others to do that.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see going forward if Amazon does more of the operation of their own fleet or if they just will find it more cost effective to outsource the management so that they're not paying for benefits for employees and pilots and things like that. When I think of ATRs, the one that I always remember is the crash that occurred in Indiana probably a little over 25 years ago. And that was a crash that occurred when the ATR was holding in icing. And my recollection is that they changed the flap position and that brought the aircraft down at that point, which led to some of the recommendations to change for icing in terms of what people do with flaps and so on. The aircraft went straight down to the ground. I think there were 60-some people on board that all died. So pretty famous crash.
The Amazon Air fleet, of course, is Boeing 737s and 767s. But they have 77 aircraft, at least according to the source of all knowledge, Wikipedia. 22 737s in service, 55 767s in service. And they're operated by a variety of airlines. The 737s are operated by Southern Air, Sun Country Airlines, ASL Airlines, Ireland. And the 767s are operated by Air Transport International and Atlas Air. And as of this report on the ATRs, Amazon Air says they've contracted with one airline to operate them, and they're looking for a second, but they haven't announced who that airline is.
Well, I was confused. You said the source of all information, and I was looking toward David there, and then you said Wikipedia. I'm like, what? Come on, man.
Yeah. Second best source.
Let's just be clear on that.
In the Seattle Times, Dominic Gates has a piece citing a serious flight test incident and lack of design maturity. FAA slows Boeing 777X certification. So, of course, Boeing is trying to certify the 777X, but the FAA sent a letter to Boeing saying that it has some concerns and that Boeing may have to increase the number of test flights that are planned. That all pushes the certification out probably more than 2 years, Dominic says, probably the late 2023. So what are the FAA concerns? Well, there's a number of them. One is that in a December 8, 2020 test flight, there was an uncommanded pitch event, something that you never really want to see. The FAA is not comfortable that Boeing fully understands what caused that event. Other issues, critical avionics system that does not meet requirements. And they're also concerned about some late hardware and software changes in the flight controls. And they want to make sure that those changes have been fully tested. So, Boeing just can't catch a break.
Flight controls and a pitch up or pitch down. Funny, where have we heard that before?
Yeah, it does kind of harken back to some previous issues. The manager of the local FAA office, Ian Wan, said that, quote, "The aircraft is not ready. The technical data required for type certification has not reached a point where it appears the aircraft type design is mature and can be expected to meet the applicable regulations." And there's another quote in the piece here from someone in the FAA who said there's a general feeling that Boeing has kind of lost a step, which I can see how that conclusion could be held, or that viewpoint could be held by people in the FAA and otherwise.
Well, I think the FAA is probably a little gun shy after the criticism of them for their role in the 737 MAX. And so I can imagine that they are probably even more careful than they would have been prior to the 737 MAX. So, yeah, I think this design is going to get far more scrutiny than it would have in the past.
Yeah, and that's not really a surprise, right? I mean, that's sort of general human nature. And I think we all kind of predicted that would be one of the impacts of the recent Boeing events, that the regulator is going to be extra careful to make sure that we don't see any additional problems crop up. All right, let's move on to Aperio in Launchpad. We see that a 4K Ultra HD flight data recorder has been announced. What can you tell us about this?
While at Aircraft Electronics Association, the big excitement was Aperio has this new A400, and at first it looks like a GoPro, but it's so much more than that. It is essentially a flight data recorder for small aircraft. And I got an interview with Chris Garberg, the president of Aperio Aviation, about it. Let's go ahead and roll that tape real quick.
Hey, airplane geeks, it's your reporter at large, Launchpad Merzari, and we're here at the Aircraft Electronics Association, and I'm here with
Chris Garberg with Aperio.
And he's got this cool new GoPro-looking device, but you know something? This is a lot more than any armored GoPro. What am I handling here?
That's correct. That's our new airborne image recorder. It's a flight data recorder with a cockpit imaging recorder, 4K camera. We capture the audio in the aircraft, the video in the aircraft, but also it has a full self-contained inertial measurement units inside the aircraft, or inside the unit itself. So we've got GPS, you get your G-forces, yaw, pitch, and roll, heading, GPS altitude, ground speed. So it's a full self-contained flight data recorder with a camera. So absolutely a GoPro, but a lot more than that, absolutely.
So this is like a black box for consumer-grade aircraft.
Yeah, it is a black box. This one actually happens to be black, but primarily actually black boxes are orange, and they're really big, really heavy, and expensive. And this is a very small unit that's got a lot of technology packed into it that is affordable for aircraft that you can install to really safety enhance your mission.
Okay. And you see yourselves installing this in, like, rotorcraft, or...?
Yeah, so we started building a flight data recorder camera with Airbus in 2011, and Airbus has been installing our Vision 1000, our previous product, since then. And so rotorcraft is a good market for this because we want lightweight and lower cost, and because weight is a big factor in rotorcraft especially. So us having a lower weight product than your typical black box per se, and then also getting, you know, it's a complicated aircraft. And historically they fly low to the ground, they fly at night, they fly in bad weather sometimes when they're doing EMS missions. And so this is a great product to monitor your flight activity, your aircraft activity. You can learn from mistakes, improve your operation.
Okay, and now it's not just internal. You're taking like FMS or engine data?
Absolutely. So correct. This camera, the latest version of this, which is the AIRS 400, which we just launched here at the event, also has an AirInc 429 receiver. So any aircraft with a 429 bus that exports data, whether it's high speed or low speed, we can consume that in this camera or this flight recorder and offload that, whether it's through the internal memory, the SD card, or cellular offload, which is wireless. We can consume that into a flight recorder analysis software and use the extra information from the avionics for to enhance the analysis.
So that would include things like engine thrust, engine RPM, rotor RPM, throttle settings.
Correct. The AIRS 400 is agnostic to you know, avionics platforms. So anything that is coming off a bus, we can consume and then send that out for analysis.
You said, you quoted to us earlier in a pre-interview about where this was used in Alaska.
Right. Yeah. There's been several, unfortunately, accidents that have had our system on that we've learned a lot from. So one very popular one was up in Alaska for a state trooper crash. He was going to rescue, I believe, a snowmobiler, and was caught in some IMC and started caging the attitude indicator, just not believing the instruments. And we were able to recreate, just watch the flight, or the NTSB, to be able to see what happened. And we learned, instead of this thing just flew to the ground, is the pilot decided to reset the attitude indicator, and the aircraft spiraled to the ground, and we lost a life. But we've learned a lot from that for training, and we can save lives going forward because of those exact accidents.
Right, because like the Kobe Bryant helicopter did not have this on it.
Correct. So then you have to use, you know, GPS data, you know, radar data, and try to recreate what happened instead of actually getting the real life, you know, the proof's in the pudding, right in the cockpit of what lever was pulled, what knob was twisted, and really what happened in the pilot's head or the aircraft. It could be a mechanical thing or it could be a human induced thing. And now you learn.
Okay. Now, is the data offloaded electronically? Do you have cell phones, or do you have to come pull the SD card?
No, this uses a worldwide cellular modem. So when the aircraft lands and removes power, this has continues with power using supercapacitors enough to offload several hours, about 6 hours of flight data each time, and it'll wirelessly offload it up to our cloud network. And so when people subscribe to our Envision flight analysis software, or FDM software, you can it's already in your account, and you can replay that and run reports on it. So it's all done wirelessly.
Okay, which implies this is priced for more for the corporate operator rather than the consumer private airplane operator.
Yeah, when you look at, you know, it's for operations that are in commercial operations, right, that, you know, have an SMS program, or they're running a flight operations quality assurance program, so even down to flight school. So we do have STCs, and it's on the type certificate of some aircraft, like, you know, the 172 and the Piper Archer. But, you know, primarily it is on large fleets that running, whether it's fixed wing or rotorcraft, that, you know, have a larger operation that are getting paid to travel. Than, you know, your smaller, you know, 172 privately held, you know, aircraft that's just using it for their own fun.
All right. Chris, if they wanted to know more, where would they go?
Yeah, please visit the website, appareo.com. That's APPAREO. And we would love to answer any questions and help you save lives.
This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved.
Yeah, this thing's about the size of a GoPro. Now, the cost, though, it's about $12,000 to have this installed. So this is more for small, you know, Part 135 operators. But it was pretty impressive because essentially it's a black box for small airplanes.
And I think charter companies and things like that are going to be very interested in it. I have a note here from the somebody at the NTSB who contacted me in the past couple of weeks who was talking about their most wanted list. And one of the items on the most wanted list for the NTSB is, quote, install crash-resistant recorders and establish flight data monitoring programs. And when I looked at that on the web, they were showing helicopters. So I think that's the big gap there, is that it's difficult to investigate accidents. Now, I do wonder about one aspect of this, which is it sounds like it records cockpit video as well. I know certainly airline pilots have been very resistant to have video of the cockpit recorded. So is this recording what's going on in the cockpit? Can people see what the pilot is doing?
Yeah, usually it's mounted in the examples they showed. It was mounted in the ceiling, firing over the shoulder of the operator. And that, like he used in that example, and they had it where you could see him reach over and cage the instruments, or you can see him reach down and twiddle with knobs. So you can actually see what's going on, but you can only hear, there's an ambient microphone, so you can hear engine noises. But obviously, it's tied into the intercom, so you can't hear people yelling at each other unless they're doing it through the intercom.
But what a capable device! I mean, it kind of checks all the boxes, and yeah, well, $12,000 around that range. I mean, that sounds like a lot of money, but for that capability, you know, it's not that bad, really.
And like you said, if you're running a standard, I forget the name of the bus, but it's the bus that all the data runs through on most turboprops, you can just tag into that and get what all the engines are doing.
Yeah. Fascinating. All right. Also fascinating, this is from AvWeb. FAA approves Virgin Galactic for commercial passenger space flights. That's very exciting. Launchpad, do you have your ticket yet?
I'm counting up my... I'm trying to see if they're going to have coupon day. because this is a great step forward, you know, into space tourism. Yeah, okay, we've had billionaires paying, what, $25 million or $52 million to go up with the Russians? But now it's a little bit, you know, well, now that I think about it, does that make Virgin Galactic the Ryanair of space travel?
Practically.
You know, because they're only, what, $200,000?
So this is kind of like being back in economy. You know, I was thinking you'd spend all that money to go up in space. And, you know, if the person next to you is just a royal pain, it's like, that's what you're going to remember is, man, I wish that person would have just shut up next to me.
Yeah. So it's been reported that Virgin Galactic has over 600 reservations for these space flights, and as you say, launch pad prices running between $200,000 and $250,000. I don't know what the difference is. Maybe a window seat or something.
Yeah. Economy versus economy plus.
Whether or not you get a meal with your ride or not.
Yeah. Dewey, if you had the disposable income, you think you'd take a trip up on a Virgin Galactic flight?
Absolutely, I would.
Yeah, I know. It's like,
come on now. Who doesn't want to go and be a part of something?
I think it'd be fantastic. I think if I suddenly, this is kind of grim, but if I suddenly learned I had a terminal illness, and
you do, it's called podcasting. Yeah, you're never going to get over it.
Yeah. I think I would do it because why not? So that's pretty exciting.
Well, and you said they had what, 600 reservations, and I think they hauled 6 or 8. Per flight, so that's at least 100 flights. So
you do wonder
They're good to go for at least a year. That's what I wonder.
It's like, is there, you know, a small group of people that are really into this, and after you work your way through that, do you then sort of have to discount the ticket to find the next group of people that are interested in going? And of course, yeah, as they achieve some, hopefully, economies of scale, maybe the price will come down somewhat. But you can just imagine that at some point, you may have tapped into the entire market that's interested in going to space and has $250,000 to spend.
I'm waiting. The next milestone I'm waiting for is like Omaze or some other charity organization that buys the seat and then raffles it off.
Ah, that's a great idea. Yeah. So what would you pay? How much would you pay for a raffle ticket for a flight like this? I mean, $100 is almost a no-brainer.
$50 to $100, because if you look at those Omaze things, they start at like each ticket is $10, but then they encourage you to buy, you know, whatever, 50 tickets or something.
All right. Well, one thing that you're definitely not going to do on a Virgin Galactic flight is exit the vehicle when it's unintended. But Max T, you know, we see all kinds of reasons for flights being delayed, but gosh, this is a new one.
Yeah, it is amazing. I still think that in this kind of post-pandemic world that people's brains must have been affected, because we're just seeing weirder and weirder, you know, behavior. Now, this happened down at Los Angeles Airport. SkyWest Airlines, which operates the United Express flights, was taxiing away from the gate. In other words, they were just getting started when a male passenger tried to open the door of the aircraft and decided to, and he succeeded. And he went down the emergency slide, exited the aircraft while they were taxiing. Now, he did have some injuries which were occurred, and so he was taken to a hospital. My guess is he was probably handcuffed to the gurney when he was in the back of the ambulance, because they probably didn't want to have to deal with what was to come next with this gentleman. Anyway, the flight taxied back and got rescheduled. No word as to whether they had to use a different aircraft, but that might have been the case. I think once the emergency slide has been deployed, that's probably more than 10 minutes to repack that and get the airplane certified to go again. So all I can say is, with all these crazy incidents, I'm just not that excited to go flying again. People just seem to be nuts, or we're just reading about, you know, this more often. But I think percentage-wise, there's more ill behavior in the air than there used to be.
Didn't this gentleman initially try to get into the cockpit, and then after he was unsuccessful at that, he activated the emergency exit?
Yeah, I thought I had read that, but I don't see that in this particular version of the story. But either way, in fact, it does say that he started to pound on the cockpit door. Now, that to me is much more normal behavior.
Looks to me is the photo shows it. I believe it's a 737, and he popped the front door. I'm lucky we didn't have engine ingesting of a slide or a passenger, you know, because dumps you right in front of the engine.
And the slide looks to be in perfect condition, you know, as it's parked at the gate.
Yeah, and the answer being is because there's just a second rope that you pull. Now, I don't know on a 737, but on many of the slides, there's a second rope you pull that detaches the slide from the airframe. And, you know, I'm just surprised we didn't have engine ingestion we didn't FOD the engine.
Yeah, yeah. Good point.
Well, pilot probably stopped pretty quickly when he heard that, hey, we have somebody exiting the aircraft. I mean, I think that would be my reaction would be to, you know, rather than throttle the engines up at that point, I would be throttling them back and stopping.
There must be some kind of a cockpit indication when the door's activated. So, I'm sure the pilot knew right away.
And I'm not sure it's 737. It's SkyWest. I don't know that they operate aircraft that big. So I'm guessing it's a regional airliner in a Brayer, I don't know, 175 or something like that.
All right. Again, we're speaking with Dewey Larson, the owner of Dream Big. Hey. Dewey, let's kind of describe what these cockpits are. It's more than just a cockpit that you're offering people an opportunity to experience. It's kind of the front of the aircraft.
Yeah, if you're you know, just an aviation guy, and I say that with all due respect, just an aviation guy, you might look at it and say, wow, that's really cool. Someone has a military fighter jet cockpit. Great, whatever, moving along. However, it's much more than that. It's, you know, it brings out the kid in all of us, and it allows an opportunity for people that will never, more than likely, never have an opportunity to experience fighter jet aviation. Allow them that opportunity, even if it's just for a moment, to just close their eyes, wrap their hands around the throttle and the stick, and just for a moment, just imagine what it must be like to be a fighter pilot. And we reinforce that with history of aviation and flight control. We teach them how to, you know, a little ground school, if you will. And then the history of the aircraft as well. And we share that with our visitors. And we make it a fully immersed, interactive opportunity without being a simulator. Simulator would take time. And doing what I do, I want to keep the authenticity of my pieces that I have.
Yeah, like as you describe it, it's more than just what you might be able to do, let's say, maybe like an open cockpit day at a museum or something like that, where it's, I mean, I think in those events, sometimes there's a little bit of the background and history involved as well. But this sounds like a much greater, possibly, learning experience.
My goal is, you know, it's twofold. We want to share aviation in a way that it's never been shared before. And then we want to keep the memory of these assets alive. And you can't often do that at a museum. Not everyone can get out, but we can come to you. And so it's a mobile aviation museum at best.
How many of these trailers do you have? Or let me rephrase that. How many completed aircraft do you have ready to go out?
Well, you know what? I have two currently on trailers ready to rock and roll right now. However, I've had multiples over the years, and those guys that now have those cockpits, they can do what I do if they choose. However, I'm the only one that does this as a full-time job. This is what I do for a career now.
And where do you get these airplanes from?
Prior to 9/11, you could pick these assets up from the boneyard out of Tucson if you were the top bidder. However, the majority of them come from people that already have them, who were in those opportunities to pick these things up prior to 9/11. After 9/11, you can't have them. The government scraps them, or they go directly to a museum. If they go to a museum, they remain property of the government, and they are issued as on loan from pieces. So if it's a Navy bird, on loan from the National Navy Naval Aviation Museum. Likewise, if it's the Air Force, it becomes on loan from the Air Force Aviation Museum. I own all mine.
How many man hours does it take for you from the time you know, they go, oh boy, it's the front end of an A7, or, you know, to...
To be honest with you, it depends on the condition of the asset once it's procured. It could take anywhere from, you know, a couple hundred hours to several thousand hours, depending on the size of the asset and what needs to be done to get it complete, the condition of the cockpit itself, the availability of the instrumentation to be acquired. Because once again, I'm not a museum per se. I am an independent company that was started on a dream, and I don't have the assets and the museum notification. However, I am a DOD licensed hobbyist, so I can use the monikers and the markings on the aircraft. I have a license that allows me to do that. So,
yeah, good thing.
What does one of these trailers weigh? What's the front end of an F-18 weigh?
The front portion of the F-18 weighs approximately... How much would you guess that it weighs? If just looking at the 27-foot section of an F-18 Hornet, knowing that that cockpit's up there, knowing that the gun is not in the nose, what would you think it weighs? The gear is out of it. Just take a guess.
1,800 pounds.
Oh, I think I would guess more than that, maybe 3,000 pounds.
You would be close.
Yeah.
3,500 pounds. That trailer, the way it weighs right now, the trailer itself weighs more than the cockpit. I have just at 7,000 pounds of weight that I'm pulling. Now, my A7, it's opposite. The cockpit actually weighs more than the trailer. It's a little beefy. It's about 6,800 pounds.
So you mentioned, Dewey, that you had a dream that caused you to go down this path. What was that dream? Yeah. What was the inspiration?
I tell you what, this is the inspiration. I did my first air show when I was 8 years old. And if you go to air shows today, nothing's changed in the fact that you can't get in fighter jets. They're ejectable aircraft. You can get in cargo planes. You can get in helicopters. You can get in the refuelers. You can climb in the cockpit and you can play with the yoke. And you can't do that in fighter jets. They're ejectable aircraft. And that's a DOD regulation. So you have to know somebody that has some clout to be able to sit inside a cockpit of a fighter jet. As an 8-year-old kid, that's what I wanted. So I told my dad, you know what, Dad? It's okay. It's okay. I'm going to have my own someday, and I'm going to let everybody in it. So when the economy crashed in 2007, and I'm like most of the businessmen out there, I lost my job. I'm like, what am I going to do? And my wife said, what did you tell my dad that you were going to do to take care of us when we retire? And I said, I'm going to get a fighter jet, and I'm going to put it on a trailer, and I'm going to never work for anybody else again. I'm going to work for myself. So here I am, 12 years in, going on my 12th year, and I'll never work another day in my life. I'm having fun sharing aviation history and bringing it around the country to as many people as I can.
Let's talk about the canopy lifting mechanism on the F-18. Is that the original? How do you charge it? How do you lift it? Or did you have to build your own that's not...
No, that's a very interesting question. Typically, whenever they demilitarize these aircraft, to get them from the government, it had to go through the process of demilitarization. So when they demil these aircraft, they take the inertia rockets out of the seat, and they take away those electronic mechanisms that allow you to power anything.
I'd assume cutting off the back half of the airplane would count as demilling.
You would be surprised. You would be really surprised. Some of these aircraft, they left parts that they normally wouldn't, and some you don't have parts where you normally would have it. This F-18 in particular did not go straight to Pima for D-Mil. It went to Boeing for D-Mil. They used it in the development of the Super Hornet. So a lot of the mechanisms to raise and lower the canopy were left, which are great. However, we're working on the charging system right now. Right now, it takes me 3 minutes and 38 seconds to crank it 87 times to raise the canopy and lower the canopy. So there you go. I call it Armstrong. It's done. It's lifted by Armstrong technology.
Yeah. So. Yes, yes.
Which is crazy. I had an F-101 cockpit. Actually, my friend that I'm staying with here, he now owns that. And the canopy weighed well over 300 pounds. And it took two of us to raise it. And it didn't have the lowering mechanism. We physically had to lift it and prop it. And then we made a bracket that we could put a T-bar in to hold it and lock it in place. Now, my A7, it's just opposite. It takes 150 PSI. You charge it up. Raises right up, lower it right back down. So it just depends on what you have to work with in the aircraft and what you need to do to make it safe for folks and then make it effective for what you're doing.
Yeah, because the canopy on an F-18 is a couple of hundred pounds.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hmm. It's beefy. We had an F-15 Eagle, and I believe it was another 300 PSI to raise that thing. And he would have to charge it with an air compressor. And it was pretty, pretty in depth.
Dewey, you keep mentioning different aircraft.
Yeah.
Why don't you keep them all? It sounds like there's some turnover.
I tell you what, I started whenever I was a kid, my favorite plane growing up was the F-4 Phantom and the F-15 Eagle. Those were my favorites. when I first started this business, I had the idea, and then I saw the A7, and I immediately fell in love with it. And I purchased it from the gentleman, and that's when the adventure started. And the time since then, now I still own the A7. It is the plane that I started with. It is the one I still own. That is the baby. It is. I have so much love and admiration for the A7 community, and it's become a labor of love. I'm an honorary bulldog. My plane was a bulldog. It was also a flying tiger when it was England Air Force Base before they moved those guys over to Moody. So we're honorary members of, you know, squadron members. So because of that, the A7 is always going to stay in my possession or my kids' possession after I'm gone. But over the years, I've acquired others. And like I said, most of these are barn finds. People have a cockpit. They'll see me on the road and they'll say, hey, my friend down here has a cockpit. He hadn't done anything with it for years. And next thing I know, my phone rings. Do you want this? Do you want this? Do you want this? No or yes. And that's how they get out and about. That's how I've acquired them over the years. I didn't even want the F-101 Voodoo. And this is a real quick story. The F-101 Voodoo, I understand the history of the turkey, and I just wasn't in the market for a dual-seat cockpit at that time. Literally, the day after this guy calls me, my friend calls me and says, hey, you know, they've got this plane up there, and, you know, this casino wants to do a Top Gun motif. And I'm like, you know what? Hold on a second. All I've ever owned is Air Force birds. That's an Air Force bird. But if you look at that cockpit just right, you can probably pass it off as an F-14. Now, then the purists are rolling over hating it. But I tell you what, we painted up that turkey, and it looked exactly like an F-14. And we put it in the casino, and that casino run paid for the whole everything that we did on that plane. And me and a friend of mine, we turned over that plane from Air Force to Navy in 26 hours.
Wow.
It was ridiculous. And it still has that same paint job on it today. And he runs it today as a Top Gun experience. So... But then again, now we go back and talk about that canopy. I was tootling down the highway in Oklahoma, and the highway stole my canopy.
No.
I hit a bump, and it went flying, and golly, it was ridiculous. But it's still out and about, and it still looks like an F-14. We call it the Voodoo Cat now.
Well, Dewey, what's the source of your knowledge about these aircraft? And I mean, do you do the restorations yourself, or do you have other people that do that?
Yeah, there's a group of us. Believe it or not, just like aviation geeks, I mean, you guys have your niche. There's simulator guys. There's cockpit guys. Some guys do hot rods. We do fighter cockpits or aircraft cockpits. So there is a small group. We all know who each other are. And for the most part, we all root for one another. We want our assets to be restored and maintained. And believe it or not, there is a market for parts and pieces out there, and we all keep an eye open for one another, and I'll find a part for someone, and I'll get it for them. And we do a lot of trading back and forth that way. And that's what keeps us alive and surviving, and that's how I've acquired a lot of my planes and parts.
Okay, now, the F-18, which came first? You getting the F-18 or Paramount going, hey, why don't you get an F-18?
I tell you what, that's interesting. Whenever they started the pre-recording of the movie or pre-production of the movie, they started reaching out to us cockpit guys. And there's a couple guys out in Hollywood, and that's their living. They provide aviation assets to movies, and they called us and because they thought we had an F-14. No, we have an F-101 that looks like an F-14, but we can make it happen. And we threw a number at them. And after the Navy had told Paramount, no, we're not going to do that, we're not going to do that. Well, Paramount started looking around. They reached out to people, and we started throwing numbers out. And then the Navy comes back and says, you're going to pay them that much? Well, we can do that. So all of a sudden, we're like, hey, what's up? So it was at that point, I knew where the F-18 was. It took me, after 3 years negotiation, I knew where the plane was 5 years ago, but it took me 3 years to negotiate terms of the deal. And I didn't tell anybody about what I was going to do except for Paramount. I reached out to Paramount. I reached out to all the production companies that were involved in the movie, and I told them my intent to do what I'm going to do. I never heard a word back until we fulfilled what we were going to do. And all they said was, wow, that's awesome. We'll watch for you. We would like to use you in our marketing and promotion of the movie. So that's what we're doing right now. We're gearing up for the release of this movie. I'm not tied in with Paramount in any other way other than the fact that we're going to do some marketing and promotion for the movie for them.
And is that still scheduled to be released towards the end of this year?
Yes. It's my understanding right now the red carpet is November 17th, and then the official premiere date is November the 19th.
Are they going to want you there for the red carpet?
I originally was contracted to show up for the first premiere, and then they were kind of standoffish of everybody for the second premiere when they were going to do that December deal. I don't think nobody really knew what they were going to do yet, but they just had the date, so they didn't really make plans with people like us. And now that they're rolling this movie out, I think that now that they've set this date in November, they're starting to reach out to us and lock things in again for the premiere. So I'm not sure where we'll be, but I know we'll be.
Has Paramount's delay helped you, as in you get a lot more appearance and a lot more buildup? Or has it hurt you because they keep jerking your chain about where you're going to be?
I tell you what, I've really thought about that because, you know, I put all this time and effort and finances and resources into getting this plane ready, getting ready for the launch, knowing that this movie is going to come out, we're going to have a great year. And then they kick the can down the curb, and I'm thinking, you know what? This may be an opportunity for us. Let's not let it come out in the middle of my air show season. Let's let it come out at the end of my air show season when I don't do anything from the end of November through December and January and February. Okay, great. Now I've got something to do. So I'm kind of looking at it like that. And also, people recognize it right now as an F-18. They don't recognize it as the markings that are on the plane. They say, hey, I've actually had people come up to me at a few shows and say, hey, wait a minute. Wasn't the Top Gun plane an F-14? What rock have you been under? There's a new movie coming out. It can't be the F-14. What do you think it's going to be? It's the F-18. It's the Super Hornet. So, yeah, we play that game. So I think once the movie comes out, obviously, the recognition, people will recognize it and see it, and then it'll become even more popular than what it is right now.
Yeah. Pre-COVID, Paramount reached out to us. And in fact, I was able to attend an event, a Paramount event, had access to some interesting people associated with the movie. And of course, COVID totally delayed everything associated with that. But based on what I was able to learn and wasn't allowed to talk about until Paramount allowed us to talk about it. But my conclusion is I think this is going to be an incredibly realistic movie, and not just a Hollywood production, but something that sounds bad to say it in those terms, but something that Av Geeks are going to be really impressed with and enjoy seeing. So, yeah, I'm eagerly awaiting it.
Not crying and banging our head like Iron Eagle 2. Right.
So, Dewey, I'm curious about the kinds of people that take advantage of what you're offering. Is it primarily youngsters? Is it veterans who kind of can relive some old memories by enjoying the cockpit experience? What are the...
Or in this full disclosure, airplane geeks?
Yeah, or us, yeah.
I tell you what, I've had air shows in the past that want to contract me for their kid zones, and I respectfully decline. And I explained, we are not a kid's attraction. We are everybody's attraction. We're for kids of all ages. I've had a 2-week-year-old in there, and I've had a 102-year-old retired flight attendant in there. So I cater to aviation enthusiasts of all ages, people that want the opportunity to sit in something that's real and have that experience. That's what we cater to.
What are some examples of some of the the best questions you get, or the I won't say the dumbest, but the most amusing questions you get?
Well, whenever you see, especially from young kids, whenever you see a fighter jet that it's on a trailer, and it may be at like at a gas station while I'm fueling up, you get what kind of boat is that? I've had that. And where's the tail of that rocket ship? I've heard that. Some kid called it a submarine a couple months ago. So they don't know, but that opens the door for me to explain what it is and to tell them the story and the history of it, and it gets them excited. And that's what we do.
It must be kind of personally gratifying to be able to introduce people to these kinds of things.
Yep. I tell you what, I love doing the air shows, but every air show that I contract, I offer up a community day. And they can utilize that and leverage that community day however they want. Normally, it's a rehearsal day, and we'll open up wherever they want. They can leverage me with a sponsor. I'll go to a car dealership, a bank, whatever. But the most of them, especially during school year, they hook me up with a school, and we'll do an appearance at a school. And going to schools, veterans' homes, hospitals, places that people normally aren't going to have the opportunity to even go to the air show to experience us, we go to them, and we're taking something special to them. That creates a buzz, and it creates a memory that these folks, no matter what their age is, they'll never forget. My favorite every other year now, is the St. Jude's Children's Hospital outside of Memphis, Tennessee. I love to go there. As a matter of fact, whenever you go and you want to do an appearance from them, they have a very lengthy vetting process. So when you do actually get to go visit St. Jude's, you're allotted a 45-minute window. That's it. Now that we've done this with our experience over the years so often, they don't even set a time for us. They go, and as long as those people are able to come out, we stay open for them.
I love that you don't display exclusively at air shows, but because I mean that's an obvious kind of a venue that's going to be beneficial for you and for the attendees. But I love that you also go to these other kinds of places that you wouldn't normally associate with aviation or right. fighter jets. And I imagine people when they see that that jet sitting there, that cockpit sitting there on that trailer, it's probably unexpected in some cases.
Oh, yeah. Even when we go to college campuses or high school campuses and we do the STEM days, the technology that went into making these things over the years, when they start hearing the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, then they can physically see it and experience it right there. Those moments are very, very cool, too. I love what I do from top to bottom, whether I'm generating revenue or doing appearances. I am blessed to be able to share aviation. So.
Do you have a published schedule of where you're going to be, some place that folks can go online? And
I do. Right now, my most current schedule has been posted on our Facebook page. And the reason I say most current is in this day and age, post-COVID events now, our schedule changes almost every other day. As a matter of fact, I just lost a show last Friday. So we will not be going to Sacramento this year. California is still kind of up. They don't know what they're doing, coming or going. And the events want to come back, but safety. We gotta stay safe. So we will not be at Sacramento this year.
I imagine you were probably at fewer events in the past, since the pandemic.
Yeah.
Probably put a big dent in your schedule.
I'll do 40 shows a year, 37 to 40 shows a year. And then when 2020 hit. I did one show at the beginning of the season, one show at the end of the season. I did two in 2020. This year, we're fighting back. I've got 22 shows.
Wow.
Are you a member of ICAST, and do you run a booth there for?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, when I go to ICAST to fit the plane in the booth, I have to have four booths. So, yes, I'll be at ICAST, and I will be at the very back corner because it's the only place they can fit the plane. And we will be there on the exhibitor floor taking bookings for 2022. And right now I've got 26 shows confirmed for 2022. So I don't have very many left to fill my schedule. So if you're a booker out there or an event, you got to hit me early because we're going to get booked up.
Well, you bring yours into the booth. Yeah, tell Sean Tucker. Yeah, bring that plane in. Where's your plane?
Well, you know what? Honestly, whenever you try to explain what I do, people just look at you like, you're going to do what? You're not going to fly the show, but you're going to bring half of a plane and you're going to do what? If they see it, they can experience it for themselves. So the cost for me to take my plane and to pay that outrageous fee and put it in that convention space, it's made up for by the shows that I would never have an opportunity to experience. So wonderful. That I did Fleet Week 1 year. I know you're from San Francisco down there, and I did Fleet Week 1 year. I would never have had that opportunity had I not met those folks at ICAST.
Well, Dewey, very exciting. I think that folks can find your Facebook page. It's just listed under Dream Big Entertainment, but we'll have a link to the page in the show notes. So if you have trouble finding it on Facebook, just take a look at the show notes, and we'll get you right to it. Any other online presence or social media? Anything else, Dewey, or is Facebook pretty much where people want to go?
Facebook, we've just started our Instagram this year. People are going that direction. So we're doing Facebook, Instagram, our website. And then I have some crew members that have TikTok and other things, and I'm biting the bullet. I eventually will probably I go live on the ramp when I'm at air shows, and they said, you got to put those on TikTok. I'm like, no, because then you'll make fun of me. So so we'll see what happens. But I love what I do, and I love sharing. And if there's more opportunities and platforms to share, well, I'm going to do it.
All right. Dewey Larson, owner of Dream Big Entertainment, thanks for joining us on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Hey, thank you guys so much for having me and just rolling with my craziness. I truly appreciate it.
All right, what's up with the geeks? Launchpad Merzari, what have you got for us?
Well, my evil plan to collect postcards is gathering steam. I now have over 12 postcards from fans who have mailed us. So of course, most of them came from one guy who sent me like 8 that were from his personal collection, wow. But I'm still gathering them. The other thing being is that if you are listener J.L. Johnson, send me in at your address because you're qualified, but you didn't send me what your address was, so I can't mail you your swag. Moving on, let's see. The Focke-Wulf, I burned 2 points on the mag, so it's kind of like getting a new pacemaker. We'll do test flights because I hope to have it in the air by the 4th. Second thing is, hey, everybody, save Wednesday, 28 July, for Potapalooza. You're invited to come meet the voices in your head and get pizza, beer, and soda and door prizes at Air Venture, which happens just before the night air show. So you're all invited.
And where is that going to be at Air Venture?
That is going to be on Celebration Way, and it's in the Pipistrel booth. And you can also come see the brand new Pantera while it's there. Now, I know Max Trescott's gotten out to look at it, but the rest of us lesser beings, you know, haven't had a chance to see it. So you can come have pizza, not in the Pantera. and meet the voices in your head and many of the other podcasters and just, you know, have a good time before the night air show.
I'm just disappointed that I don't have a psychiatrist, because I would imagine he or she would be very interested in attending and actually meeting the voices in my head.
Yeah. Yeah.
Having them fill out a questionnaire. Right,
right. What are they telling you? All right. What else?
Speaking of questionnaires, last thing I got is, I have a trivia question. Okay. Think about a biplane. We're talking World War One biplanes. We move on and we go up to the serious biplanes of Stearman. Now, this is a trivia question, so Dave, don't answer this because Dave knows all. So you think about it, you know, biplanes, we get to the pinnacle, which is kind of like the Stearman, but you keep going and we end up with Christie's and I can't think of the other brand that are now used to fly acrobatics in the 80s up into the 2000s, like the Oracle. Yeah, Christian Eagle. And you think of those biplanes. Now, think of a biplane that's not a tail dragger. The only one I can come up with is a Waco on floats, because then it's got like quad. Yeah. But think about a biplane that isn't a tail dragger. When you think of one, put it in our Slack listener team on the episode channel, which makes an excellent idea. Dave, if they wanted to be part of our Slack listener team, how would they do that?
Send an email to launchpad@airplanegeeks.com.
Yeah. Or the geeks at airplanegeeks.com. And we'll send you an invitation that you can click on and get into our Slack listener team. There's a lot of activity. I've been kind of offline a lot lately, but I have sort of returned to the land with internet for, well, maybe 2 weeks here. I'm trying to get caught up with our conversations in Slack, but there's a lot of stuff going on in there. But a tail dragger, well, a biplane that's not a tail dragger. Somebody's going to know the answer to that who's not David. And I guess, do you know of one?
I don't know. Okay. I can only think of one. So I'm going to let it go
good,
at that.
Good. Yeah. All right. Let's see. So I am planning to do the Spurwink Farm pancake breakfast and fly in Maine on... What month is this? This is July 11th. And then there's a good chance I will get over to the vintage sailplane activity following that the week. And then probably head over to Wisconsin for Oshkosh. So that's my near-term plan. So I hope to see some of you there. All right. Anything else? Max Trescott, nothing aviation-wise of note going on with you?
No, just incredibly busy flying. I just came off of a weekend where I was flying the Vision Jet, posted some fun pictures on Instagram. So I would say, folks, check out Aviation News Talk on Instagram, and you can see some of my photos.
So are you doing flight instruction, or are you doing ferry flights, or what kind of flying are you doing?
Sure. So I'm working with a couple of different people who have purchased Vision Jets. In one case, it's someone who is headed off to do their check ride shortly, so I'm prepping him. In another case, it's someone who's done his check ride but doesn't have a whole lot of hours on his belt under his belt and hasn't flown much at all for the last few months. So out, doing recurrent training. So it's fun either way.
And on his Instagram, he makes 1980s foreigner puns.
All right. We have a little bit of listener mail. Tom wrote to us. One of the articles he sent us is from stuckattheairport.com. This is kind of an interesting article. It's first a passenger drought, now a water drought. Can California airports cope? As many of you know, there are some significant water shortages in the western United States. In fact, there's something called the U.S. Drought Monitor, and we see that they report that almost 95% of California is experiencing severe to exceptional drought conditions. So, of course, that affects everything. This article is, what about airports? And it's reported here that many airports have learned from past droughts, so they're not really maybe getting as caught out as you might think. Some examples are Sonoma County Airport. They've removed the grass from many locations. They're using drought-tolerant plantings. And they've even upgraded the car wash facility. It actually captures and then recycles 85% of the wash water. But some other air...
That's cool.
Yeah, isn't that kind of interesting? San Jose International Airport, you might know about this, Max. Recycled water is used in restrooms and to hand wash the terminal windows and also to water drought-tolerant landscaping. They have automatic toilets, or automatic faucets, rather, low-flow toilets in the terminal. In fact, other airports are also using waterless urinals. Some airports, if you're at a...
Isn't waterless urinals, isn't that the definition of being outside?
It's pretty close. I don't know why they work so well. I mean, you would think that there would be all kinds of problems with that concept, but the ones I've seen, I don't know. They don't seem to have any issue, but... other airports are capturing rainwater from the top deck of the parking garage, capturing water from air conditioning units. Of course, the air conditioning process takes the humidity, the moisture out of the air. That's why air conditioning units drip water the way they do. So get this, San Diego International Airport has captured 100,000 gallons of air conditioner condensate annually. 100,000 gallons annually. It's just phenomenal.
And that's probably just from the terminal building. I would imagine that the aircraft probably drip plenty of water while they're parked in the gate areas.
So the bad news is there's a drought. The good news is that the airports that would otherwise maybe be really negatively impacted or contribute to the problem by consuming so much water are taking these kinds of actions to reduce the water consumption. It's a good news story, I think.
And we've had practice doing this for a while, so drought is not uncommon here, and this year it looks like it's probably going to be as bad as it's ever been. You mentioned the recycling car wash water. That's been pretty common in our local car washes, not at the airport, but just everyday ones. They've been, I think, actually required to recycle water for a number of years, so you can't just flush it down. They are required to recapture it.
Well, another drought story, another aviation drought story comes from Patrick Wiggins. This is an article in Clean Technica. Drought reveals 1960s plane crash in California Lake. Max, I don't know if you saw this, but this is about a Piper Comanche 250 that crashed in 1965. And not much was ever discovered about that until recently.
Yeah, what's kind of interesting, the lake is at an unprecedented low level. That's a Folsom Lake, which is northeast or mostly north of the Sacramento area. Very large, both recreational lake as well as a man-made reservoir for storing water. But it is down so low as are most of the reservoirs. Most of our reservoirs are very low right now. And somebody happened to spot this aircraft down underwater, and I think they used sonar to recover it. Normally, the water would be so deep that sonar wouldn't be able to reach it, but the water level is so low that they spotted this Piper Comanche 250 that crashed, killing four people. And so now the local officials are going to be meeting to talk about the possibility of recovering this aircraft.
Yeah, fascinating. It mentions that only one victim's body was ever recovered, but one guy, Frank Wilcox, who just passed away 3 years ago. He spent nearly his entire life searching the area for looking for signs of his brother who was in that plane crash. So another story that doesn't have to do with a drought. Ryan sent this to us. Archer Aviation, of course, they're in the urban air mobility space. And our guest in episode 653 was Archer's chief engineer, Dr. Jeffrey Bauer. But with the closing of Aireon Corporation, of course, many engineers were out of work looking for employment. And so Archer has hired over 20 of them, and they'll be utilizing that talent for Archer's aircraft design and also certification roadmap areas like aerodynamics and flight controls, avionics, structures, systems engineering, system safety, program management. So it's interesting to see that pickup of that talent. That's good. And of course, Archer recently unveiled their demonstration aircraft. They call it Maker. And we'll have a link to that. So Archer's continuing to roll along with their progress towards developing the eVTOL aircraft. Okay. That will do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank you for listening, of course. And we want to thank our guest, Dewey Larson, owner of Dream Big Entertainment. Dewey, thanks again for coming on the show and sharing all the, you know, the great stuff that you're doing and the tremendous amount of fun you're having, I think.
Oh, thank you. Thank you guys so much for having me. And absolutely, I'm always going to be a kid at heart, and I'm just a big kid making dreams come true for people. So that's what I do. Thank you so much for having me, guys.
Love it. Love it.
Thanks for the photo, Dewey.
Hey, you're welcome, buddy. I'll look forward to seeing you down the road at another show.
Hey, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. You'll find show notes there. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, including where to find Big Dream Entertainment's Facebook page, that's at airplanegeeks.com/659. Of course, you can reach us via email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And David Vanderhoof, if people want to reach you, where do they go?
They can find me on our Slack listener team, like we talked about before, which is you do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And if you've been listening to this podcast for billions of years, or it seems like it, you can. That's where you can find me, at all of the usual places.
And how about you, Max Truscott?
Well, I will encourage people to check out my Instagram page. Head on out to Instagram, do a search for Aviation News Talk, and then follow that account of ours, and you'll see all kinds of photos posted. I think I've got 7 pictures going up this week in the queue, so all kinds of good stuff coming up.
And you're not on TikTok, huh?
You know, I think that they've got an age limit on TikTok,
and
just slightly over the upper limit there.
I feel too old for TikTok. I mean, I barely feel old enough for Instagram, but TikTok, that's for the youngsters, I guess. Maybe I'm showing my age. Mr. Launchpad Marzari, where do folks find you?
Well, this weekend I'll be at the Texas Air Academy fly-in for the 4th of July. Come by, say hello. And of course, I'll be at Oshkosh. Come by, say hello. But electronically, I'm Launchpad Marzari on Facebook. I'm Pilot Launchpad on Twitter. And then I'm on our Slack listener team, where we do lots of good stuff every day.
Terrific. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com. Spell it out. All words, no numbers. And that'll point you in all the directions where you can find me online. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Frequency change approved.
And thanks for listening.